Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we've got a lot from the big box space, including Kohl's and Target. One Texas real estate firm releases their statewide commercial real estate report, and the results, well, they might surprise you. At the risk of being a little bit clickbaity at the beginning of the show, one reminder, it's the last week to win an I Love Retail coffee mug by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. Simply leave your email address or Twitter handle in the review, and whoever wins will reach out to you, and that coffee mug will be on its way. Another reminder as well that we'll be at the NRF Big Show coming up just a couple of days after this podcast will air. So looking forward to New York and looking forward to coming out of that with a few retail insights and some great interviews lined up for the next few weeks for the podcast. We open today's show, though, with Target. Target warned of weak holiday sales several months ago, but we know now that the retailer might have been sandbagging as they reported better than expected holiday results. Now, Target said in mid-November when they released third quarter earnings, they expected a highly competitive, and I quote that, holiday shopping season and that earnings could potentially suffer as a result. But we know now that that was not necessarily the case for Target as they came through with better than expected results on multiple platforms.
Well, for the second Retail Focus podcast of the year, I'm extremely excited to bring positive news stories. Trent mentioned Target, but we have a ton of others, all focusing really on positive sales. And this is going to be a theme for the next few weeks as a lot of retailers report their third and fourth quarter earnings for fiscal 2017. You see that sales are coming in positive figures, but also earnings per share is going to be up as a lot of retailers have been able to extract better than expected margins. As for Target, the company released increased guidance for their fourth quarter and therefore their full fiscal year as well. The general merchandise retailer executed well for the holidays, hiring ahead of the curve, as we had talked about, so that they could give adequate training to nearly all functional areas that would see surges in business, including their distribution centers because of their omnichannel platform. But for their two-month holiday period, November through December, Target has released a positive same-store sales figure, 3.4%, much better figures than they had earlier this last year when both sales and their share price were down. There were many that said Target would have problems with core categories because of pricing, that competitive nature within the general merchandise arena, but also because of lags in rolling out more aspirational omnichannel-based platforms, thinking that that would actually draw attention away from those leadership teams. But overall, you see that some of the same categories that a lot of people were saying were going to be a little soft were actually the strongest during the last few weeks. Food and beverage, apparel, home essentials were all impressive. And this was according to the company, as they reported five essential categories that saw boosts overall and in comparative periods. You see, they raised guidance consisting of adjusted earnings per share between $1.30 to $1.40 per share compared to previous guidance of $1.05 to $1.25 for the fourth quarter. Sales will also be up, as much as same-store sales even, meaning that they have not necessarily been boosting those online-only sales as much as they would have hoped. However, for the full year, fiscal 2017, Target expects its adjusted earnings per share guidance to be between $4.64 per share to $4.74 per share, from a prior range of $4.40 to around $4.60 per share. But Trent, it's really a story of retail bullishness. We've been talking about the stock market as of late, how it's affected a lot of retailers, a lot of companies that supply retailers. But you can see as it pertains to Target, their shares have been up for the past year now, approaching a one-year high.
And I think perhaps the best sign from Target is the fact that we talk all this time about omnichannel and omnichannel directives, and omnichannel for a while, especially in 2016, was a buzzword for a lot of different retailers. When you look at a business like Target, though, it really seems as though they're doing omnichannel right. And they mentioned in their latest release, as well as on the earnings call several times, this number, 70%. That's how many digital orders were fulfilled by brick and mortar stores in the fourth quarter, in specifically the November and December period. 70% of all these orders touching stores, that's right in line with a retailer like JCPenney, for whom many online orders still touch those brick and mortar stores. And while you see a lot of bearishness regarding brick and mortar retail, even still, even with traffic numbers going up and same store sales going up across the board, with a business like Target, that number really does suggest that the brick and mortar presence Target has is ever more important. And it also lends some credence to Target's expansion program with their urban Target setup or their college campus setup. Remember, we've talked in the last couple of years about Target moving into these locations that are often 22 to 30,000 square feet. Most recently, they moved into a location in Austin, Texas, right across from the UT Austin campus. And again, that location right around 2,300 square feet. Part of the reason they're doing that is because their brand as a whole, Target, rates out very well with college students and particularly members of fraternities and sororities. Better, in fact, than Amazon. So while you hear a lot about Amazon and Target being tied together over the last couple of days, and even in fact over the last couple of weeks, is people speculating that Target could potentially be a purchase option for Amazon. Look, there are things that Amazon does well, but Target does certain things well, and part of that is their branding, and part of that is their homewares. And you mentioned a number of categories boosting, but number one among the categories that they mentioned during the earnings call, they mentioned it also in the analyst Q&A, was the home category for Target. And that is huge when you look at these smaller locations designed for urban areas or designed for near colleges. If they can extract value out of that home area, as well as the apparel area, which actually saw growth in November and December as well, that's a positive thing for Target. And again, you're continuing to brand. We see that branding reaching over into their marketing efforts. Their marketing efforts speak mostly about making a Target run. That term has become synonymous with going out for essentials on a lot of college campuses. And I think that's something that we need to look at here. Everyone is talking about, well, Target might struggle. Target is struggling to adopt omnichannel. The reality of it is Target's one of the few retailers that's actually firing on many, if not all, of their cylinders when it comes to an omnichannel approach. And second, we forget about the Target brand, which is still very, very strong despite the headwinds from things like boycotts, despite the headwinds from things like negative press, in part because of giants like Amazon. Target is still rating very high amongst their customer base. And we talk about those boycotts and whether or not they've affected traffic early in 2017. Well, they didn't early in 2017, and their third quarter traffic was up to help to show for that. Their fourth quarter traffic, or more specifically, their holiday traffic, meanwhile, saw growth in addition. And not only did they see growth in stores, but they saw growth online as well. So the fact that they're seeing growth in traffic, the fact that they're pacing online sales at a pretty good rate, their digital sales grew by more than 25% in this last quarter. I think these are some positive signs for Target. And that's one of the reasons why, as Leighton mentioned, you've seen that stock surge as we head into the third full week of 2018.
Shares have been riding a hot streak as of late, up $16 a share, or that's 29% over the last 2 months, currently approaching a one-year high of $73 a share. They've also been aided, like I said, by retail bullishness, but several companies have come out with good news during the last 2 to 3 months, and that has directly related to some of the increases Target has seen. Moving on to our second story, another positive story that's focused around holiday sales. Kohl's has been in the news for their Amazon partnerships, but it's those very holiday sales that put them in the headlines this week. Perhaps all of that positive PR of late benefited the retailer in terms of traffic. Kohl's boasted over 1,100 stores in 49 states during their latest quarter, according to the company's website. And on Monday, the company released a corporate sales update for November and December, as well as full-year fiscal 2017 guidance. And this made shareholders happy, to say the least. Kohl's same-store sales for the 2017 holiday season climbed 6.9% versus the same period a year earlier. As with Target, they reported positive comps in core categories, but a little bit different. They reported positive comps in all categories, not just their core categories, all categories, which may have been a surprise to some. I know it was to Trent and myself. Kevin Mansell, Kohl's chairman and chief executive officer and president, said, "We are very pleased with our holiday period sales, which were consistently strong through November and December. All lines of business and all regions reported positive comp sales. As expected, growth in digital demand accelerated significantly in the holiday period from the year-to-date trend." And this is a company that was kind of down in the dumps. If you looked at the stock, if you look at the company's performance 18 months ago, a lot of people were criticizing one aspect of the company, one that we will be targeting for this specific story later on, but their real estate, talking about the stores are too big, they have too much merchandise, they have too much inventory of like items, and all of those things the company has really honed in on, especially the inventory. And we'll talk a little bit about that and how that affects their real estate going forward, but really trying to be efficient in every way they can. The company now sees full fiscal 2017 diluted earnings per share to be between $4.10 per share to $4.20 versus its previous guidance of $3.72 to $3.92. So that big difference there, that percentage change, tells you how they're being a little bit more efficient and drawing money to the bottom line. Those better earnings per share numbers are not only a function of higher sales during the holiday season, but those better margins mean lesser selling, general, and administrative expenses, according to the company. And this is most interesting, Trent, because if you go back to a podcast around 2-3 months ago, we were talking about all the holiday hiring with companies like Kohl's, with companies like Target, companies that are really trying to get ahead so that they can train their employees. Well, Kohl's was one of them. They ended up hiring around 67,000 temporary workers over the holidays, which for 1,100 stores may seem like a lot, but it's around 2,000 people less than they hired last year. They hired 69,000 people last year. So this means they've been looking very closely at how they can be a little bit better operationally. And maybe last year they saw the 69,000 and said, you know what? We can trim that by 1,000 or two. And now you see that really lead over into Q4 results, or prospective results at least, in terms of earnings per share numbers. Those employees often require hourly wages, of course, but they also extract important resources in terms of the training teams, hiring them and putting them on board to make sure they know what they're doing, especially those jobs that are a little more sensitive with the distribution side of the business. The workers also typically receive a 15% associate discount card, so you do have to factor in those potential sales, and that those sales are going to be a little bit less than the MSRP for those items they carry in the store. But Trent, what is most interesting here is the fact that those earnings per share estimates are not taking into consideration an important item that nearly everybody is talking about inside the media landscape.
That's right, those tax reforms, and they mentioned they don't know how much the changes to the tax code will actually affect the bottom line, but they seem pretty sure that the changes will lead to some sort of a lesser tax burden compared to previous years. One other note on Kohl's actual operational side of things before we get to a few real estate notes with Kohl's. Kevin Mansell was also presenting at the ICR conference this week, and he actually had a keynote that was nearly 50 minutes long, but in that keynote talked about something that I think a lot of people, when they look at Kohl's, tend to gloss over, which is that membership program, the Yes to You Rewards program. He talked about how robust that program was, and Layton spoke to inventory. Now, you can track inventory by just looking at certainly raw inventory data, but he spoke to how they were using the rewards system to track what their most regular habitual consumers wanted out of Kohl's. And I think overall now, they're starting to get a little bit more of a grasp on the data that's being generated from that program, from rewards members, and they're starting to give rewards members more of what they want. It allows them to be more efficient rather than a blanket strategy, which in turn leads to some open square footage because they're able to be more efficient with their square footage, which brings us to the next news story that came out regarding Kohl's this last week. Stores for Kohl's average around 80 to 90,000 square feet, which is quite large. It puts them in certainly a big box position or a major anchor position in a lot of shopping centers. Well, Kohl's has been working internally over the past year to strategize on how to better utilize its large footprint, especially now that they're starting to trim those inventory costs and be slightly more wise in how they spread that inventory out through the store. They've been reducing that in-store inventory, not only to reduce the amount of cost of goods sold or reduce that on the balance sheet, but also manage to boost the amount of space they have at their disposal. Right now, they have about 300 stores, right-sized, they called it, over the past several years. So this would be 300 of the over 1,100 stores they have in their store network. And this was mentioned to CNBC at that same ICR conference where Kevin Mansell had the keynote speech that was nearly 50 minutes long. Well, now Kohl's is currently looking at national credit tenants, or in other words, well-known banners that will drive traffic and be willing to sign longer-term agreements to make use of some of that square footage that isn't being used currently in Kohl's. So, Leighton, I'm wondering if you can explain to us what a national credit tenant is and who some of these businesses might be that Kohl's is looking to partner with.
Yeah, a lot of speculation about who those tenants may be, but to answer your first question, a national credit tenant is often a term used in the commercial real estate industry, talking about those tenants that are highly vetted, that have been around the industry for quite some time. So you talk about a national credit tenant in terms of maybe a grocery store or a convenience store. Maybe a 7-Eleven would be a convenience store. And as for a grocery store, anything under the Kroger banner, or you talk about a convenience store hybrid, talking about a Walgreens or a Rite Aid location, you know that those businesses are always going to pay, and they're always going to pay on time. So having a national credit tenant is extremely important. You're looking at the longevity or the long-term value of real estate. It's important to have those in your portfolio. In terms of what Kohl's may do, a lot of speculation here again, but company management has alluded to the idea of opening up a grocery store or a convenience store inside the Kohl's store, or potentially cutting off and barricading that store, but the overall goal being to attract more traffic to a particular shopping district. And Trent talked about right-sizing 300 of its stores currently, really reducing that inventory, making way for a potential partnership long-term. But this is an interesting story because this is more than just extracting value from their current real estate holdings, trying to be a little bit more efficient. This has to do also with the potential Amazon acquisition that everybody's been talking about. Everybody has their special short list of retailers in the brick and mortar space that Amazon may or may not look to acquire. Well, you know what? Amazon did just acquire Whole Foods, and Whole Foods has been trying to grow as of late, but those particular areas that Whole Foods is really prominent in, those are expensive areas. In fact, a Whole Foods that just opened up near me is at one of the most expensive locations in my city because they're looking at the higher demographics. So in order to spread out into more locations, Whole Foods really doesn't have that big of a square footage in their average store footprint. So perhaps Whole Foods could have sort of a 365 concept, perhaps, in those Kohl's locations. So again, another piece of speculation that a lot of people are going to go and run with. But I think this is going to be something where, again, whether or not a potential Amazon acquisition happens, I think it's going to be good for the concept. And this is something that Trent and I talked at length about for the last 2 years in regards to Sears and Kmart. More on the Kmart side than the Sears side, but really talking about how Kmart could leverage a large percentage of its 90 to 110,000 square foot buildings, form partnerships, get other tenants inside, not only to drive traffic, but to help kind of release those expenses quarter after quarter that they've been having as far as occupancy costs and the like. I digress on that particular topic, but you look forward to the Q4 results. They're expected to come out for Kohl's on March 1st around 7 a.m. Eastern time, and will host its quarterly earnings conference call at 8:30. Certainly a conference call that Trent and I will be turning into, at least in terms of the audio or the earnings transcript thereafter. But a lot of goings on with Kohl's, again, a lot of speculation, and shares have been going upward since the aforementioned partnership with Amazon, but recent results and more rumors of other happenings with inside Kohl's operations have sent shares even higher. Shares of Kohl's, ticker KSS, are up over 50% over the trailing 12 months. And on this positive news here of guidance and same-store sales, shares were up another 3.7%. Shares are up near a 2.5-year high, around $62 a share as of recording this podcast.
We've reached the halfway point of the Retail Focus podcast, which means it's time to talk a little bit about the Internet Retailer Conference and Exhibition for 2018. IRCE is your one-stop shop for all of your e-retail needs. This conference and trade show offers you everything your business needs to stay ahead of your competition, and it offers it in one location. Spend some time with them to learn, discover, and network. IRCE 2018 will take place in the world-class and centrally located city of Chicago, Illinois, June 5th through the 8th at McCormick Place West.
IRCE offers two full conference days with various tracks with pre- and post-conference workshops discussing all the new trends in the industry. The exhibit hall at IRCE features over 600 top solution and technology vendors ready to help your business succeed in every facet. The hall covers over 250,000 square feet of space, which is almost like 2.5 Sam's Clubs, making it the largest e-commerce trade show in the industry, ensuring you'll find the solutions you need there.
Here's some numbers for you. Just astounding. 10,000 attendees, 600 plus exhibitors and solution providers, and over 130 conference sessions with more than 200 speakers. Alan Cohen of Houzz is the first main stage speaker announced for 2018. Go to IRCE.com and click Register to Attend under the Attendees tab, and please enter promo code RETAIL18. That's RETAIL18 for 10% off conference passes. IRCE.com, promo code RETAIL18.
Well, we're back with our news portion of the Retail Focus podcast with a real estate-related story as Texas seemingly takes a point position nationally in retail real estate growth. Even though the U.S. is often talked about as having too much real estate square footage, those still making the trip to their local brick-and-mortar stores still demand bigger stores and more open spaces. This is a trend that is not going away. And while articles of doom and gloom in retail are abundant, especially this last year and a half or so, retail vacancies in the U.S. are expected to be down overall from 11.9% at the end of 2017, or at least in the last calendar quarter of 2017, to 11.1% at the end of 2018, or at least that's the projection. So we're looking at a lot more retail businesses occupying space. And while many analysts, including some of our past guests on the podcast, suggest that the U.S. is over-retailed, the Texas data we'll be discussing here in this story suggests that only certain parts of the U.S. are over-retailed, while others, particularly in major metropolitan areas, still have room for growth. With certain metropolitan areas still growing in terms of population density, for instance, Austin, Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio, and Houston among them, there will be greater opportunities for retail real estate development. For Dallas, this trend is no exception. While the area grew its retail square footage by 4.2 million square feet last year, developers are still looking to add another 3 million square feet this year. Bob Young, executive managing director for the commercial real estate firm Weitzman, said that their market isn't overheating and potential for new space is all over their town. The Weitzman Group has provided the 2018 Shopping Center Survey and forecast for the state of Texas, highlighting a ton of positives for the local economies. The tagline there for the report is, "What Retail Armageddon?" And Trent, I think that is an apt description of this report. And we look at first the city of Austin, where the retail occupancy rate is well higher than the national average at 96%, in fact. This, despite the total Austin inventory growing by 32% over the last decade, from 37 million square feet of retail space to now 48.8 million. In comparison to the population growth, retail growth is favorable. Austin's population was nearly 750,000 in 2007, is now nearly 932,000, which is an increase of around 24%. It said that many retail vacancies last for a week or two before a backfill. But Trent, tell us a little bit more about Austin. And I know that you're excited because you're always visiting Texas, and in particular, some of these markets that are actually booming while previous analysts had said they're a little bit stagnated.
And that's one of the reasons why we include this story here. You might be wondering, well, why on a national retail podcast are you looking at just the state of Texas? Couple of different reasons for that. One is that the Weitzman Group, this survey and study that they publish is a very complete one, and it's a very objective look at the real estate landscape for retail businesses in the state of Texas. So when things are going bad or poorly in a market, they tell you that things are going bad or poorly in a given market. Here, a lot of positivity in their report. The second facet of this is that Texas does have some of the largest metro areas in the country. And you look at two metro areas in particular, Austin and San Antonio, they're among the quickest growing metro areas in the country. And of course, Dallas-Fort Worth, or DFW, as we'll call it for the rest of this story, and Houston are among the top 10 metro areas in the entire country. So despite the fact that this study is a little bit more regionalized, we feel like it certainly builds to the concept that in larger metro areas, brick and mortar retail still has room for growth. And despite the fact that you get a lot of backfill overall, we see in a couple of markets in particular, there is a lot of room for square footage growth for the next couple of years. And we're talking about Austin here. The occupancy rate in Austin, Leighton mentioned 96%, far above the national average. This is aided by a really low addition of retail square footage last year. Just over 600,000 square feet were added. And you have to wonder if developers, despite the fact that Austin is a growing city, were potentially scared off by negative brick and mortar retail news that were out there. So because of the lack of new square footage, backfilling of existing vacancies was necessary. And that certainly happened, cutting their overall vacancies by 33% in the last calendar year. You look at some of the stores that are doing this backfilling. Total Wine and More led the way. They filled a total of 3 spaces in the last calendar year. All of these spaces are called junior boxes or smaller big box stores that were previously occupied. And while we discussed Golfsmith's 2016 struggles a couple of years ago, turns out that the golf retail sector is still strong enough to backfill in Austin, at least, with a Golf Galaxy going into a former Golfsmith location. Other backfillers include Florin Decor, who's jumped on old Kmarts in the past. They actually opened up in a former Super Target that moved. Petco and The Tile Shop were among other retailers that hopped into old real estate. Now, in terms of Austin, we mentioned the slow growth this last year. There are some big projects planned for the next calendar year, one of which is The Park, which is scheduled for completion in 2018. This is a power retail set, includes a 365 by Whole Foods, which is the first of their kind in the Austin area, Dick's, Marshall's, and Nordstrom Rack, totaling 400,000 square feet. And of course, there are some smaller projects with grocery stores as anchors. Overall, you're looking at new development of around 1 million square feet in Austin for next year. Moving just north on I-35, as in Austin, the DFW metro retail occupancy rate also above the national average, although not quite as high at 92.5%. 92.5% for a retail occupancy rate, actually low among Texas metro areas for DFW, in part because there are some areas a little bit down on their luck in terms of trying to fill that occupancy. It's a little bit more spotty in DFW. Some areas have nearly 100% occupancy, whereas some areas lag down around 80%. And in Dallas as well, inventory growth is outpacing population growth. So they are building new retail real estate over the last 10 years at a higher rate than the population is growing. In fact, 20.3% increase over the last 10 years in retail real estate available. New inventory in Dallas this last year hit a high watermark since the Great Recession, in fact. So in 2017, 4.2 million square feet of retail real estate space was added in the last calendar year, again, the highest mark since 2007. And something instructive in Weitzman's DFW report is the breakdown of occupancy rates at different shopping centers. They divide the shopping centers into 4 different categories: community centers, which are usually anchored by a grocer, neighborhood centers, which are typically unanchored, so kind of think strip malls there, power centers, we mentioned one of those in Austin opening up next year, typically co-anchored by small, mid, and big boxes. Kohl's, Five Below, who we'll talk about in a second, fall in there, as would Total Wine or Whole Foods or Dick's. And then mixed use, which is a retail, residential, commercial mix, kind of a planned community, and also malls. So you have 5 different bins here. And looking at the bins overall, power centers saw a whopping 94.5% occupancy rate, which was above where the occupancy rate had been the last few years. Part of that, of course, strong growth in the off-price sector, TJX businesses, as well as Ross and Five Below, although not off-price with Five Below, have been jumping into a lot of these shopping centers. And community centers come in pretty strong as well at 92.7% in terms of the occupancy rate. The latter said to be boosted in the last year by Winco Foods' recent focus on DFW. In the past, Winco, a Western United States food retailer, but they've been pouring resources into DFW and it's paid off for the community with higher occupancy rates. And one would assume, because this is broken into these bins, that the mall category, given all of the press that's out there, would be struggling. But I think this is where I was most surprised in this entire study. In Dallas, which is really a lot of people credited as the birthplace of enormous indoor malls with the Galleria just north of downtown, Dallas still sees malls going strong. In fact, occupancy barely moved from last year. Occupancy rates at 93.6% in Dallas right now. That's despite two Macy's closures and a Neiman Marcus departure. Those were the three main anchor retailers to leave malls in the last calendar year in Dallas. So despite that, they were able to backfill those spaces. And we believe, honestly, Leighton and I do, that this supports the notion that some markets can still support traditional indoor malls, Dallas being one of them, Houston another, especially when the market maintains those properties in the A or B class. When you look at Dallas, there are very few C and D class malls in DFW, and that's in part due to the fact that they've kept their aging malls, like the Galleria, up to date. Also, strong suburban nature in DFW, which helps to support some of those A and B class malls as well. So remember, when you hear about malls perhaps failing throughout the U.S., it's oftentimes dependent on metro areas. Some metro areas, Dallas and Houston among them, tend to do very well when it comes to the indoor shopping malls. Speaking of Houston, Leighton, they had impacts from Hurricane Harvey this year, but their occupancy rate barely budged.
Yeah, it did. Remained strong in 2017, dropping only slightly from 95.6% in 2016 to 95% in 2017. Also, 2.8 million square feet added just this year. So with the hurricane only slightly impacting new construction, we see the Houston area is very strong going forward. Backfill leaders here include Total Wine and More once again, while new construction found a willing anchor in multiple new Kroger stores, and this is always very important. We tend to see that grocery stores are anchors for these types of newer shopping centers. Total Wine and More must increasingly compete with Specs in Texas, and we can see that they are snatching up real estate to try to battle with this up-and-coming chain. We look forward to our last city here in this report that we'll talk about, San Antonio, as they saw occupancy increases to 94% in 2017. As with Austin, very little new construction, just 400,000 square feet added there. However, repurposing was at a max here, most notably at the River Center Mall in downtown San Antonio. And Trent, you were actually there this year and were impressed with the overall redevelopment, seeing it firsthand, where they're using an adjacent historic downtown building to grow square footage by around 65,000 in occupancy there, almost at capacity already, with a lot of interest in that particular area. And of particular note, IKEA will arrive in San Antonio in 2019, which will end up boosting overall square footage by 800,000. That store alone will be 289,000 square feet in space, serve as a retail hub on nearly 35 acres of land adjacent to Interstate 35 and Loop 1604. And as we sort of conclude this whole real estate story and the goings-on in Texas throughout 2017 and beyond, we see that strong office occupancy numbers, strong retail occupancy numbers, really brings to the idea that metropolitan real estate is very strong in the United States. And in particular with retail, you see a lot of retailers not struggling to make those lease payments. And we mentioned at the top of the story that vacancy rates are actually going to be down for 2018, or at least towards the end of 2018. But there's a lot of dynamics to look at going forward. A lot of things we'll be talking about in the podcast to come as we talk about the certain dynamics and finances of the retailers most often in the news. First, we look at wage increases, which may mean that retailers will be less willing to pay on lease increases because they already have that selling, general, and administrative expense going up in the short to midterm. Long term, they may be a little unwilling to pay their landlord a lot of money going forward, but we do know that commercial leases tend to be a little bit longer, between 5 and 15 years. and oftentimes have different options built in within them. So those options typically already have lease rate increases there, but curious to see that dynamic going forward. And three potential rate hikes for the federal funds rate this year, which may mean to some that the Fed is going to actually push out some investors in the commercial market. The Fed has most recently raised its rate 25 basis points to around 1.5% in December. This could mean less investment overall also, but you see that the cost of debt service in turn goes up for those needing to take out loans for these different properties, either new development or redevelopment. However, that all being said, still a lot of strong development with new builds as we have just outlined with Texas. So I am curious to see what 2018-2019 holds for the retail industry, but as it looks now, a lot of these bigger markets are flourishing with all of these new concepts that are coming in and doing quite well.
We finished the news portion of the Retail Focus podcast this week with more positivity. Now, if you thought a 50% share price increase for Kohl's was impressive, Five Below displayed strong growth in 2017, which moved shares over 60%. Now, this story isn't about all of 2017 for Five Below. We've covered them multiple times on the podcast, but they did release a peek into their earnings from the holiday season. That's what we're here to talk about. The company announced its strongest holiday sales, in fact, since their IPO in 2012. The company's net sales for the holiday period rose 26.7% to $442.6 million. Now, if you're wondering how much of that came from new construction, quite a bit of it did, but their comp sales still saw robust growth of 6.7%. And Leighton and I were talking before we came on the air. We thought only one analyst we were able to find, and that's Vincent Cinci from Morgan Stanley, we'll talk about later on, had comparable store sales above that 6.7% mark. So despite the fact that it was less than some were anticipating, it's still more than what a lot of analysts had in the bag. Five Below stated that it expects fourth quarter and fiscal 2017 guidance to be in the higher end of their guidance range that they provided earlier. Revenue for the full year is expected to be between $1.264 and $1.276 billion. Now, the top line revenue, that would set a new record for the company because, again, they are growing. They've opened over 100 new locations in the last couple of years. Earnings for fiscal 2017 thought to be in the range of $1.72 to $1.79 per share. Now, I mentioned that some of these fourth quarter projections that they released ahead of their earnings call that'll eventually come out in a few weeks were actually less than analysts were anticipating. Again, Leighton and I only noticed one analyst that had them above that 6.7% mark, but it was enough to push the consensus estimates up a little bit. Earnings per share were a little less than analysts expected, too. Consensus estimates had earnings per share at $1.17. The expected earnings per share projected to come in between $1.09 and $1.16 per share. And then revenue was projected to come in from $491 million to $503 million from the fourth quarter, which, again, surrounds the expectations there from analysts of $501.1 million. Now, Leighton, one of the things that we talked about before coming on the podcast is that analysts have criticized Five Below for being more of a one-trick pony. Some feel that they'll have a hard time differentiating their product selection enough in the future to keep people coming in particular millennials. But we personally see growth for the next 4 to 5 years for Five Below if they can stay ahead of the trends.
This is a business that you and I have loved, and this was on our year's end list last year for a business that is really hitting on all cylinders after a lot of skepticism. You talked about the spinners, seeing a lot of criticism from analysts, but it's interesting because other businesses in this space avoid criticism. We talk about Dollar Tree, for instance, and they remain on a robust growth-centric track. KeyBank Capital Markets downgraded Five Below because they felt like the company could not retain customers post-fidget spinner fad, and optimism was built into the stock there. However, we tend to align our views more with Morgan Stanley's Vincent Cinci, who said in late December that Five Below was able to maintain traffic counts despite no pressure of a fad. He is a larger believer that the overall direction of the company is going to be positive. Cinci forecasted, as Trent alluded to, potential 7% same-store sales in December. And you see that this company this is a company that we talk about all the time in terms of management execution. This was a topic that Trent and I were talking about before recording this podcast, was this is a company that has potential for a number of more stores inside the United States, a lot of white space out there because they only have 600 stores in around 32 states. And this is a company that has seen massive growth, and a lot are suspect as to whether this can be sustainable growth. But I think it really lies on management's execution going forward, because this is an extremely interesting business in that your product selection, your product assortment has to be dead on for what your core consumer wants. But so far, they've been able to execute at such a high level that they beat expectations quarter after quarter after quarter. And as a result, you see the share price almost double during this latest year. So I think this is a company that it is a really good company. The questions that surround this company should be tailored more to the long-term view, in my opinion. I think the 5 to 10 year mark is really what's going to tell if this company is going to be a success story or not, because in the 1, 2, 3, 4 years from now, I think they're going to do just fine because of not only that white space, but because the management in place currently has really already proven out their strategy. The company has been going in the opposite direction against those skeptical analysts with a larger assortment of electronics and really trying to always stay ahead of these emerging trends we see within the toy industry and advertising them so very well on social media. And this is something they do very well. If you just Google Five Below, immediately you get drawn to their Twitter account where they're advertising some of their new products. I think this is extremely important, and you can't really assess a value to that level of marketing expertise. There's really only one Five Below currently, and you see this strategy really playing out, and it's a profitable strategy. Regardless of them missing barely their fourth quarter earnings per share marks, this company is doing very well at growing in a sustainable, profitable way that I think can really give shareholders value, again, at least in the short to midterm. Executives have also talked about extending their digital presence and selling more online. And this is something that we've said in the past, and we'll stay true to this now and say it again, in that the company really isn't required to sell these types of things online because these are more impulse buys. And Trent had expertly noted this before recording this podcast, that a lot of people need to come into the Five Below stores, the physical brick and mortar locations, to try and play with these toys and see if they want to buy something, bring their children in. It's more of an experiential thing for this particular retailer. So I think overall it is good to have a digital presence. Obviously, it helps your social media if you can attract more traffic, but it's not necessarily something that's going to massively boost their top line sales. Previous to this, their website was more of a gallery of items that they have in store, as well as their store locator, which all company stores and websites pretty much have. But I think, again, a little bit of digital sales for maybe your hottest selling items, that's a good thing. But to have all of your product assortment online, shipping's going to be a little bit expensive. It's going to be a little bit of a burden long term, especially if you're looking to compete with the Amazons of the world, because you're not Amazon. You fit perfectly into the specific niche of selling items $5 and below, and you really have to look at the core competencies of this business to see that they shouldn't be going off of their current track.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I look ahead to a story that'll be perhaps newsmaking over the next week or next month or next year. And in this circumstance, Leighton, we have an interesting story that broke while we were recording the podcast. News coming today that Sam's Club abruptly shuttering 63 locations, many of these just closing today without any notice to workers other than a FedEx envelope showing up at some of their houses. And Leighton, I know you've got several different takes on this.
Yeah, we're talking about Sam's Club, which is obviously wholly owned by Walmart Incorporated. And this is a company that was near and dear to my heart, but a little less dear after the story came out. And we're looking over the details now, Trent and I are. And you're looking at 63 Sam's Clubs in total across the United States that are going to be closed. And this, according to Business Insider, you look as of Thursday afternoon, a lot of employees being turned away. a lot of employees getting ready to go into work, not getting that FedEx notification, or at least not seeing it in time, and then looking and seeing that the doors are shuttered. So I am very curious as to why they're doing this and why it has to be so abrupt. Because if you look at the sheer amount of people that this is affecting, around 170 to 200 people per store, that's an average, on an average basis, around 11,000 people could be impacted in total. And it's kind of unclear as to why these stores, or at least some of these stores, are being closed. Some of the stores are going to be turned into e-commerce distribution centers. But as Sam's Club has actually grown over the last few years. They've actually added dozens of stores, and they've been highly competitive, not as competitive as Costco in the big box arena, but they've been doing very well. But from the company side of things, they said that Sam's Club has actually grown a little bit too fast in some of these metropolitan areas that they thought would grow in terms of population, sort of a theme we're talking about in terms of the Texas real estate story. It looks as though they may have actually been off on their predictions for some of these communities. But the people that are going to be hurt the worst are those workers and those local areas. And I think this is just a shame and a lot of negative PR for a company that has really been on a hot streak as of late. We see shares over $102 a share, an all-time high for Walmart. A lot of positive comps via e-commerce sales, via brick-and-mortar sales from the holiday season with Walmart and Sam's Club. So I'm very curious as to the thought process that went in on this. And the CEO, John Furner, actually notified employees of the closures after some stores had actually been closed via email on Thursday. And he said, after a thorough review, it became clear that we had built clubs in some locations that impacted other clubs and where population had not grown as anticipated. But again, the onus is on the company itself, really looking at these projections before they build out these massive clubs. These clubs are not inexpensive to build, millions of dollars in development, and then you have to hire all of these people to be able to work inside these locations. To be honest with you, this is something that I never thought we would have to be discussing, because year after year, Sam's Club, yes, they close maybe 5 to 12 locations, those ones that are going to be underperforming or the locations that may be closed down, and they may decide to build a new location 1 or 2 miles away in a better shopping district. That is totally understandable, but 63 locations, and if you look at the list again on businessinsider.com, you can see all of the locations geographically these locations are going to be in. It's really just a shame. You really have to question the thought process again, because you see over 6 locations in the state of Illinois alone. I know a lot of areas around the Chicago metro area, but 2 locations in Indianapolis. Are you to say that both of these locations were underperforming because of the population growth there? They surely had the foresight to look at the demographics in that particular area, considering it is one city alone. A lot of interesting marks to be made here, and I am very curious as to see a further explanation. Again, we have a quote from their CEO, the Sam's Club CEO, but I'm curious to see, with all the negative PR, all the tweets already surrounding the story, if they have anything more to say in regards to the story.
And you talk about negative PR. They're closing 3 locations in Puerto Rico, who are some of the businesses that were helping Puerto Rico kind of get back on their feet. Still a lot of that area without electricity, without running water. That is awful PR for the business to end the Sam's Clubs in this way, to not actually do traditional liquidation. And on top of that, Leighton, you talked about the Indianapolis market. One of the interesting things is, and he said it both in the letter and in other statements as well as Sam's Club tweet, is that John Furner mentioned that they built some clubs too close to other clubs. There was this cannibalization effect going on. Well, they're closing all 3 of their Sam's Clubs in the Seattle, Washington metro area. So you're talking about a business that's trying to build an omnichannel presence, yet they are neglecting one of the top 15 metro areas in the United States by exiting the Seattle market. And look, I know Costco is there. I know you've got stiff competition there, but I think that gives us some insight into the fact that Costco was probably eating Sam's Club's lunch in the Seattle area. And Leighton, one final note, you mentioned, you know, a lot of employees probably have things in their lockers. They're not being allowed in at the 10 or so Sam's Clubs that have closed almost immediately. And there are some that will be going out of business over the next 3 to 4 weeks. So that'll give employees time to kind of move on. But for employees of the 10 or so clubs that closed abruptly this morning with basically no warning other than a FedEx envelope in the mail, that's a difficult scenario. And they'll have to find ways, obviously, to get their belongings back inside the stores. It said, again, 10 to 12 of these will be turned into regional distribution centers to end up fulfilling online purchases. But again, not a good omnichannel look when they're completely exiting certain markets throughout the country, Seattle being one of them. Just a head scratcher of a move here at a time when Walmart was just collecting point after point of positive PR. They take a big negative PR hit on the chin. And they did mention also that they were increasing or looking to increase their company-wide minimum wage to $11, which was going to be my looking ahead story as we got news of the Sam's Club closures coming across our wires. But Walmart, again, boosting their minimum wage to $11. We'll see how that'll impact retention, but also the bottom line going forward for the company. But one final note on Sam's Club here. You look at the locations they've closed. Obviously, the explanations don't really add up with the age of the location. You kind of wonder in the back of your head, especially with all this talk of mergers and acquisitions in the retail space, if maybe Sam's Club doesn't have something in mind, if not for the real estate, because they own all of that real estate, maybe for their wing of the business. We mentioned closing all those Seattle locations. Is there a reason they don't want to be in competition with Costco there? We shall see, and time will tell. So shocking news to close out the retail focus. It was a retail focus of positivity until we got about halfway through and started to see these notes coming in about Sam's Club's closures. For Layton, I'm Trent. We'll be again at the NRF Big Show next week, and we'll have some great interviews coming up on next Friday's episode. Certainly looking forward to that. And make sure you tune in for next week's episode. Give us a follow on Twitter at Retail Podcast. And also make sure and rate us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.